The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Our guest, Alice Elliott Dark, is the author of the critically acclaimed novel, Think of England, and the short story collections, In the Gloaming and Naked to the Waist. Her stories, essays, and reviews have appeared in the New York Times, Plowshares, and The New Yorker. And her story, In the Gloaming, has twice been adapted into feature films. A writing professor in Rutgers University's Newark's MFA program, Dark has earned a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, an O. Henry Award, and inclusion in several literary anthologies. A novel about friendship, class differences, and societal expectations for women, Fellowship Point tells the story of a delicate but devastating rift between two lifelong friends. Tonight, Ms. Dark will be in conversation with Beth Kephart, the author of more than 30 books across a wide range of genres, including Going Over, Handling the Truth on the Writing of Memoir, and most recently, Wife, Daughter, Self. A writing professor at the University of Pennsylvania, she is the recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts grant, a Pew Fellowship, and the Speakeasy Poetry Prize, among other honors. Please welcome back Alice Elliott Dark and Beth Kephart to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Hello, gorgeous. Come and join me. Thank you for having us here. And I'm really happy to be with this very famous woman. I feel intimidated. She's glowing in her green. We've been having a fun conversation backstage. We were talking about joy and how we manage all the wonderful things that are happening to Alice right now. But I felt that this book was written just for me. I don't care what you say, this is for me. It has Philadelphia architecture and history, which I love. It has the sacred responsibility to our land, urges toward memoir, children's book, Waverly Heights, where my father was for the last few years of his life. You referenced Marilyn Robinson's book, one of my favorites. How did you manage to put so much beauty in this book, so much that is so relevant to so many of us?
Well, thank you so much, Beth. Is this good? Where this is? Okay, first place, Beth, I'm so happy to be in conversation with you because you are the writer of Philadelphia. There's no doubt about that. And I've just admired you for so many, many years. And it's so fun to be talking to you on a stage.
Again, after so many years. Remember when we did it at Penn? Years ago.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. That's interesting because I think the places in the book, which are Philadelphia and Maine, basically, are places that really live in my imagination. I lived in Philadelphia. I grew up in the Main Line. I went to Penn, and I lived in Philadelphia after. But I really haven't lived here in many, many years. So it's an imaginary place for me at this point. My son lives here, so we come down a lot. But Philadelphia's changed a lot since I was young. Yeah. So I experience it more as a destination than as the way I did when I was young. Yeah. And I did so much research for this book that all of the parts of the past of Philadelphia, the 19th century factory life, and just the early industrial years of Philadelphia, that's all part of my imagination of Philadelphia. So I would say when I'm writing it, I'm writing an imaginary version, not trying to be 100% realistic, but it's capturing my feeling of how much I love it. So I think that's what you're picking up.
What are your research shelves look like, Alice? You're talking about the amount of research you've done. You know, I do love to read about Philadelphia. What does it look like on your shelves where it says Philadelphia somehow?
Well, I have a lot of books. And of course, the internet. I mean, you can see so much original material now on the internet, yes. which is incredible. You don't have to go to, you know, sorting through the library like we used to have to do, and sorting through all the microfilm like we used to have to do. There's so much available on the internet. So a lot of my bookshelves are the internet.
Well, you have been garnering terrific reviews. Joan Frank in Boston Globe talks about the book as being dense, bristling, I love the word, and multi-layered. And she promises the reader that this part of Maine that you've imagined will become so intimate, so known, that you don't have to kind of, you know, fix it in your mind. And it is the absolute experience, Alice, of reading this book that one just feels that we are living there. And in the opening pages of the book, there is a map. And I wondered if you could talk about, I asked you backstage, you said that you had drawn a map of the place. Talk about how the map evolved in your own mind, how you drew its contours, and then how you began to populate it.
It grew out of the story. It came out of just the scenes. I had an idea, these two women will live next door to each other on this piece of land, and then someone else lives here, and someone, and it, you know, eventually I had to sort of draw a diagram of where everyone lives, but just to keep it straight in my mind, and that evolved into a map over time. And my editor said, why don't we have a map in the book, which I was very excited about, because I love all those old-fashioned books with family tree, map, all of that stuff. So I was very thrilled to be able to do that because I thought it was appropriate for this novel. And so I drew a much more exact version of it than the one I used as my working version. And then I passed it over to a man named Jeffrey Ward, who's a computer map maker, and he did the final map.
It's interesting because, you know, you have such a, we as your readers never get lost in time, in place, and when someone is traveling a road or walking a path, we understand the distance they are going, and that's a tribute to the quality of your work and your writing. And this book is, and now I'm going to read this part because I want to make sure I don't lose any of it, this is a book that is deeply peopled with complicated, complex people who have a habit of burying their authentic selves until somebody else insists on seeing them truly. So at the center of the story, we have Agnes. She's in her eighth decade, and she's learned in the opening pages of the book that she's not well. We have her best friend, Polly. We have a young, dashing editor named Maud. I am so jealous of this Maud and the relationship and the mother she cares for. We have the Philadelphia Society. We have Summer on a tip of land. Many characters, but it's never overpeopled. They have interesting relationships with each other. They're unexpected, the way the relationships unfold. At what point in your process did these characters that show up in this final version of the book, because I know there are many pages that did not make it here, when did they begin to talk to each other in your head?
I love that question. I think probably very early, because just the way I figure things out is I put characters in situations that are stressful and see what they do. That's how I figure out what they're like. And a lot of those stressful situations can be conversations and how people handle it, how they get into it, how they get out of it, what they do afterward. And sometimes, like one of the exercises I give to my writing students, for example, is I say, you have a first class ticket on a plane, and which is very unusual for you. It's not someone who always has that, but someone, this is like their big trip. And then you get there and they say, we're overbooked, you have to go sit back by the WC in the back. How does your character handle that? And I have them write it with Scarlett O'Hara, what would she do? And then, you know, some characters that we really have absorbed and understand what they're like. And then they get a sense of, okay, we understand a Scarlett O'Hara and we can imagine what she would do. And people pretty much imagine the same thing for Scarlett O'Hara.
Interesting.
And so I do something like that with my characters. I have them interact and I have them interact under situations where there's some stress or challenge. So that's an early stage, though. When they start to really talk to each other, I think what you're referring to, as they do in the book, which is a little bit of a later stage after I know them. Yeah, it's hard to say exactly when that happened, but it's not something I do. It just starts to naturally happen.
They are seamless conversations. They are credible. They are also suspenseful conversations, and they also manage to be literary and lyrical in their own way. And as I've mentioned, your Agnes is a writer, and she's got a bit of writer's block. She also works under pseudonym in the book. You inhabit her. There are so many smart places where you are commenting on, thinking about writing. I wondered if you could read to us from the first section that I had brought out for you to read, to give people here a sense for what that sounds like.
Okay, this is a section just talking about Agnes, thinking about her writing. She writes two different kinds of books. She writes children's books for basically for money, although nobody really knows about that. She's told when she's 40 that the money that she's inherited is not going to last enough to keep this fellowship point going. So she has to make some money. So she starts taking up this career of children's books, which works out for her because it's a book. It doesn't, you know.
It doesn't always work out for all of us, just so you know.
And she also has a secret writing practice, which is these novels about, they're Mary McCarthy-esque kind of novels about young Philadelphia women, but we see them, she writes one every decade. So this starts when they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and she's working on the final volume at this stage of her life when we first meet her, when she's 80. So there is a lot about her writing in the book, and I'll just read this one brief section. But there was always more, wasn't there? Recomposing the familiar was apt to expose a fresh interpretation. Memory was hazy and capricious, but bearing down on memory with words, examining it with all the senses, and representing time with light and technique, this shook up the past, unfixed it, kneaded it, and bent it into a new shape. Sitting alone at her desk or on her chaise writing in her journal, she went deep into life. She felt vividly involved with the entire world when she was writing. Alone, literally, yet she was choosing words with the intention that they serve as stepping stones between herself and the mind and heart of another person. It was a miracle that this was possible. Small black marks on a page, a code called the alphabet, and she could read a story written hundreds of years earlier, or write a book read thousands of miles away. Why get excited about gods and ghosts when writing and reading were so supernatural? When she was with another person, the choice of words wasn't so crucial. She could point to a flower and smile and trust that her appreciation had been communicated, but she couldn't write the word flower and expect a reader to know what she meant. What flower? Red, white, yellow, blue, what size, what scent, what season? To draw a scene wholly from her mind and draw it well enough that a stranger might see it too, this was her way of living, and it didn't seem any less active than commanding troops or performing a surgery or having children.
Did that come easily to you?
That passage?
Yes.
Probably.
See, she's so nice that we don't mind when she says things like that. Because that is really hard to do. That kind of precision in capturing process is really difficult. And you are someone, we were talking backstage, and who really just enjoys sitting and writing. You really just love it. And when you have to throw away, as you did, hundreds of pages from this not-so-slender book called Fellowship Point, you didn't mind because you had enjoyed the process of creating those pages. You teach, you are a beloved teacher, but did writing passages like that, did writing this book teach you anything new about writing?
so much, Beth. It was such a bigger project than I had ever thought that I would ever take on. I was a poet until I was 28. I didn't even consider writing prose, except for the journalism I wrote for the Shipley newspaper. You know, I didn't consider myself to be a fiction writer before then. And even when I started, I was writing stories. This was came out of the blue, that I just suddenly decided I want to write a big novel. I want to write a 19th century style novel. I want to learn how to do it. And it was more for the fun of it. You know, it was like, okay, there's another form. I don't know this form at all. I want to learn it. I want to see what it's all about because I've gotten so much pleasure from reading those books. And I wanted to get on the inside of it and see at least how it was done by me. Obviously, I can't possibly know how it was done by Trollope or someone who wrote like 50 amazing books, like with unbelievable plots. That's just supernatural to me too. But I learned how to do this. Not that I could say I could sit down and write another one with ease. It would take starting all over again. But having done it, the other thing I really learned while doing this, and I think this can apply to many things in life, is that I would find the answer by waiting. I put it in, it was like putting money in a candy machine. Okay, I put the quarters in, which are, I want to figure this out, this problem. And then I just wait. And then, you know, it could be a year later when I figure out the answer to the problem. But by the end of this book, I thought, wow, you know, I just have to be patient and I'll figure it out.
Can you help us understand what a typical problem might be?
How do I get this subplot to make a difference to the main plot?
Ah.
I'm interested in this character, Robert Circumstance, who's a landscape designer, and he actually works at the Fellowship Point as a caretaker because his family has worked as caretakers there for a long time, but he's gone up in the world and outside of their life. But he's like a son to both Polly and Agnes in the book. So I was very interested in him, and I actually wrote a whole draft of the book that was just Polly and Robert. It was just the story of their relationship. But so I had to figure out, how is he going to fit in to this version of the book? I want him, and I love him, and I want him to be important. That's that kind of a problem.
I noted, too, how masterfully you handle both flashback and sort of interior worlds of your characters. And I wonder if one of the problems you had to solve was figuring out seamlessness and transition.
I mean, over time, yes. I think the way I do it is, I just let happen what happens when I'm writing, and then the effort comes in fitting it all together.
Sure.
I'm not effortful when I'm drafting. I just let flow whatever comes out.
Yeah.
And then I start to work on it and shape it and put it together. And then it's a whole, I mean, you know, it's a whole different process, editing, than writing. So I think that's where I struggle more with making things fit together.
Well, you don't feel the struggle in this final version of the book. So friendship. Yeah, I once wrote a book, Into the Tangle of Friendship, a memoir of the things that matter. I thought that maybe I could be wise on the topic of friendship, but it turns out I'm still trying to figure this out in my own life. That lies at the heart of this, Polly and Agnes's friendship, other friendships, Maud and Agnes's friendship that it develops. And I wonder, when I was writing about friendship, and I still do write, I write about broken friendships, lost friendships. I'm sort of obsessed with that these days. What did you learn about your own friendships, your own way of approaching friendship in real life by having to get these two women, you know, the various friendships, you know, put onto the page here?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of friendships in the book, actually, of different sorts. But, of course, the Agnes and Polly friendship is central to the book. And I did not really think about it when I was writing it. It's something that's been pointed out to me, how big a part of the book that is. But I've always had close friendships. I've always been very invested in friendship, partly because I think I went to Shipley and it was a girls' school, and I went from K to 12, so I knew a lot of the same girls for 13 years. Yeah. We still know each other. We stayed in touch, you know, and of course, not all those friendships are deep friendships, but the lesson of those friendships, I actually wrote something about how to stay friends, and a big, you know, number one was let things go, you know. I think, like, there's so much emphasis now on talking things out, confronting. I'm like, no, at Shipley, we did not do that. You know, if you got mad at someone, you just waited a couple days and you picked up, you know, you picked up at the high mark.
Yeah, that's so funny because in working on a new project, I've been going back through all the ephemera of my life, and there's a letter from my sophomore year Penn roommate who said, "We could have been much better friends, but you could just not let X go." So there you are. Where were you when I was a sophomore at Penn, Alice Elliott Dark?
Well, it's tempting to talk everything through, and there are moments when it's appropriate. But I think a lot, in very long-term friendships, I think so much is let go. And it's just like, and until it gets to the point, and this is true of long marriage too, it gets to the point where you just accept. And, you know what's not right. You know where the person's lying to themselves. You see it so clearly. But you just don't bring it up.
And yet in this book, Polly and Agnes's relationship does come to a head.
It does.
Things that have not been settled or spoken, you know, it does ultimately come to a head, which is part of the suspense
of the
book.
Yeah, and it was fun to do that. Something I wouldn't do in real life.
I love the way you handle the flashbacks, particularly of Polly's husband. You have him, I don't want to put words in your mouth, talk about how you're handling Dick's past life and then read a section for us.
All right, well, I did have four male sections in the book that I cut because it was way too long, and that seemed an easy way to extract a few hundred pages, to just make it a book about three women instead of a larger book with all these other characters. So I wrote a lot of material about Dick in a different form. And then when I was compressing it, I went back and had him talk about a lot of those incidents in his life in the very early mornings. This is toward, you know, when he's just becoming more loose with how much control he has over his mind.
Yeah.
Especially in the early hours of the morning. And Polly, his wife, goes in and sits with him then. And then she's, one of her big goals of the book, I'd say her big goal is she really wants to become close to Dick finally.
Yes.
She's lived with him for 60 years. He just retired. She thinks, okay, now's my now it's my turn. And it doesn't quite work out the way she hopes, but this is where it happens. In these early morning conversations, when he isn't trying to be anything other than speaking from his heart and telling about things in his past that he's never talked about before. So, all right, I'm just going to read a little.
And it feels dreamlike.
It's very dreamlike.
And one of the things she's been waiting for is she's been waiting to be seen.
So much.
Yeah.
I loved writing this part so much, I have to say. Okay, so this is, she's listening to him and he's telling this story, but it's written, it's paraphrased as what he's saying. It's not, it doesn't say I, it says he, but it's what he's telling her.
Yeah.
Where's Polly? Dick asked. I think she's in the kitchen, someone said. So he headed back there. through the quiet, empty rooms, brown and cool, noticing the light scents of salt and mildew. He remembered his way through the dining room around the corner and through the swinging doors into the pantry, and then a left into the kitchen, and there she was, standing at the sink, humming. The water running. Beads of water bouncing off the bottom of the ceramic sink and back up against the side before running down again, circling the drain. She hadn't heard him come in, so he saw her as she was, without her love coming at him. Mm-hmm. Her hair in bunches, her nose pink, shoulders peeling, feet turned out like a ballerina's, holding a plate in one hand and a sponge in the other, soaping it dreamily, making it look as though being alone in the kitchen washing dishes was the most exquisite thing a person could do. She had a private life, a source of pleasure other than him. He would be able to love her now and not feel guilty that she loved more. A gentleman loved his wife. He asked her to marry him shortly afterward.
You know, that line, without her love coming at him, is just devastating. That's the kind of thing you do so well, where you are, you know, it's smooth and it's beautiful, and yet these are lacerating little moments. You know, he could see her as she was without her love coming at him. Is that the sort of thing that, are you going to make me even jealouser? Is that the sort of thing that also comes easily while you're just happily writing?
Well, I mean, you know, saying it comes easily, it's built on years of work.
Years, though, of observation. Because that is, it's one thing to be able to write the words down. It's much harder to have the thought in the first place.
Well, that's the other thing I was going to say there, is that a lot of the part that's not easy is arranging to get to this deep place in my mind where it just comes. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't do it. If you said right now, just write a page, it wouldn't happen, because I haven't had, you know, I haven't gotten into a place where it's more meditative. Mm-hmm. I have to go to a meditative place. Then it does come. Easy makes it sound like something that is not as considered as it is, but it's sort of a whole setup to be able to do it.
Yeah. So I just mentioned that I've been cleaning out my files lately, and one of my best friends who must have... It is so interesting to keep finding letters that people wrote to you when you were 18, 19, 20 years old.
Are you keeping them, or is this like the big clear out?
No. You are speaking to a memoirist. How could I throw this stuff away? I literally want to find out who this Nick guy is, who I apparently almost married and have no memory of him. I don't know.
Facebook.
This is one of my best friends from Penn, and she was writing to me over the course of one summer, and she said, "Oh my God, I thought my grandmother was just my grandmother. But I sat and talked to her for 2 weeks. Do you know how smart she is? And she went to school, and she was medical school, and she knows more than I do. She's read more than I do. How did I not see her as this really potent, important person, not just to me, but in her life?" And you love writing. You loved, especially in this book, writing, but for your whole life you've loved finding the older person in the room and listening for their story. You said something in a recent interview about what the world would be like if 70 and 75-year-old women were visible and active and made more active, if society allowed that. I want for you to share with everybody here what obsesses you about that age. Why did you want your two primary female characters to be that age?
I have always really been fascinated by old women. It started when I was a child. My grandmother took me every Sunday after church to see her great aunts. So to me, they were great, great, I don't know, they were 90 or something. And she was in her 40s. I mean, that's, my grandmother was in her 40s when I was that age. And
wow.
I know, it's a different world.
Are you going to write a memoir, Alice?
Maybe, I don't know. But anyway, we went to see Rhoda and Lil. They live somewhere off of Conshohocken State Road. And I thought this huge house was their house, but it was a nursing home. And they just lived in, they were sisters. They'd lived together all their life. And they just, I thought they had the greatest life ever. They just had everything set up in their room the way they wanted. They painted. They had candy and in their room, you know.
What kind of candy?
I just thought, wow. It was those kind of jellies that are, you know, lime and lemon and that have like a semicircle.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they would offer those. And they wore like very Victorian dresses. They didn't wear bras. I thought that was amazing. And the whole thing, I thought, this is freedom. You know, these women are free. I said that to my grandfather once, and he said, yeah, well, I've been paying for them for, you know, okay. But, you know, to me, that looked like a great life, an unencumbered life. And it just kind of has gone on from there. And I particularly like women like Agnes, who has money, has no husband, sorry husbands in the room, because this is just a fascination of mine. It's not a value judgment. But just, you know, is able to make her day any way she wants. And yeah, I it was surprising to me when I realized I was writing about people like that, because a few years ago, someone said, what are you writing about? And I said, well, I have these two old women in Maine. And as soon as I heard myself say that, I thought, oh, my God, I'm writing.
I think you said that to me when we were at Rutgers.
I
remember you saying
that
when we were sitting there.
And I was like, oh, my God, I'm writing something no one's ever going to read. Like, this is like, who would want to read that? I mean, it is not, you know, it's not a plot starter. You don't see them running. You don't see them, you know. But I just think one of the reasons I was very interested in them is I do think older women are interesting. Older men are interesting, too. I mean, older people are interesting. And they're not given a lot of weight in our culture. I think either our children, wage earners are given weight in our culture. When you're in the economy and you're working within the economy, you have a say. But if you're a child or if you're older and you're out of the economy, you're sort of like pushed aside because what you say doesn't really matter to the economy in a certain way. So, but I think there's a really interesting thing that happens when you don't have to be a participant in the regular run of life. And I do think that, I mean, 70, 75, I would go up to 95. That I think maybe even older as we get, our longevity changes. That
95
there's a,
is
a lot
good.
Of room for women to be much more political actors than they are right now. You know, we see like a Nancy Pelosi. There's room for a lot of people like that.
When I say 95 is good, I mean for myself. I can't imagine living beyond that.
I know. Can't imagine it now.
Land is integral to the story, and this is a story about sanctified land. And then so there are no women running at the start, but there's a cool whale moment. There's a real, which is so active and so perfect, and I want you to read those pages.
I actually did purposely make these women physically active.
Yes, they're walking, they're wailing.
They showed me a cover that had, like this cover, but it had two Adirondack chairs with women sitting. I said, in this whole book, you never see these women sitting outside together.
Yeah.
They're always walking. They're climbing the rocks. They're swimming. They're doing physical things.
And wait a minute, the people at the publishing house listened to you.
They did.
Well, there you go.
That's
your power, Alice.
That was lucky.
Your special power.
All right, so here they are on a whale watch, and this is a description of the whale that they see. The crew knew all the whales and introduced them by name as they appeared. A few came close and communicated with the boat, soaking up the admiration of the ooing and clapping audience. Over and over, a patch of water swirled and imploded, then sucked back from its center to make way for a huge, bright body to leap into the air, streaming from head to tail gallons of the sparkling sea. The whale lofted and airborne paused, miraculously defying gravity so easily that the watchers invented a fresh hope that the great creature with its huge staring eye might live among them like a cow or an elephant, so they could encounter each other at leisure rather than in brief and unpredictable flashes. Or maybe it was she, Agnes alone, who could easily persuade it of a different possible outcome to the same old story.
Were you on that boat?
I have been many times.
Yeah. Do whales fascinate you?
Yes. I mean, everything about the sea fascinates me. You know, especially, yeah, I mean, everything about the sea fascinates me, and the idea of this whole world that we don't mm-hmm. participate in. Mm-hmm. That really is very indifferent to us. Mm. You know, we're hurting it now, but when we weren't, it's just very indifferent to us. And haven't you read, like, all those old whaling books and...
You've read more than I have. No, I bet you finished Moby Dick, right? You finished Moby Dick?
I finished parts of Moby Dick. I can't claim. I'm sure my son has read the whole thing. He's read all the books.
I see from Andy we have room for just one more question, so I'm going to make it the easiest one that was on my list. And that is, what is your hope for readers of this book? And it is a two-part one. What can novels achieve in this world in which we are living?
I would say I hope that people will enjoy this story. It's really meant to be an entertaining story with a lot of challenging ideas mixed in, mm-hmm. things worth thinking about. But I feel that I love to go to this place, Fellowship mm-hmm. Point, every morning when I woke up, make the coffee, feed the cats, and then, you know, go there. And that's how I would like readers to feel, too. Get up, feed the cats, make the coffee, go to Fellowship Point, and just immerse mm-hmm. in this other world, which I think has a lot to offer in many ways. And my main interest in writing is thinking about change and how people change. And it's complicated. And I have the characters change in this book. And I think it's a long book because some of the changes they go through require many little steps along the way yeah. to make it believable
yeah.
that they actually do change at the end. So I would hope that it's something like, you know, you started with the map, but it's like a map for change, how people can change and how to make meaning of your life along the way.
I didn't even get to ask you how Fellowship Point became both the name of that land and then ultimately the name of the book. We didn't get to talk about Alice McDermott, but I think you're right up there in terms of the way you craft. I know.
Oh, my gosh.
And no. I know that you were in Lit Hub today for anybody who wants. You were talking about how characters change, how you mm-hmm. learned to help your characters change. So if anybody wants to find out more about what she thinks that way. But now, this is your turn to ask the great Alice Elliott Dark a question.
Hey, Alice.
Hi, Sam.
Starnes, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good, I met you about in your class maybe 20 years ago
yeah.
when you were starting this book.
That's so nice to see you.
Congratulations. I wondered, like, was it painful to throw that many pages away, or do you read the finished copy and think, wow, I wish I'd saved that scene, or I'm going to use it again? Because that's, I know I read about, you know, you wrote, what, more than 1,000 pages, and how much did you throw away, and how much did you save, and are there things that you missed from what you threw away?
Definitely. There were things that were very hard to throw away. Things that I had done a lot of research about, and I really wished I could have kept in the book. But, you know, it is, ultimately, it has to have some kind of shape and balance, and some of those things couldn't stay in. The first chapter of the book, was cut, which was seeing Agnes and Polly when they were 14. And an incident happens where an eagle is shot, and they make like a finger prick pledge to each other that they're going to protect the birds in that part of the land for the rest of their lives. So it was kind of a setup, and my editor felt that it wasn't necessary. But I did love that part. I had a whole part of the character Robert Circumstance, who I mentioned earlier. He went to prison for a couple of years, and I had not a whole lot of writing about life in prison because I did not feel qualified for that. But one specific, very interesting incident where they moved all the prisoners from the old Main State Penitentiary to a new Supermax in the dead of night in buses with no lights. They just put them in the buses and moved them. They didn't tell them where they were going. And that was in 2002. So it happened, you know, during the years of the book. And there are a lot of accounts of it by people who it happened to that were really fascinating. And I was sorry to cut that because it was an amazing historical incident. And I kept a lot of it. I didn't keep all of the stuff I cut. I kept a lot of it. It's, you know, it's sitting in computer files. Will I ever go back to it? I doubt it. But I couldn't just throw it away. Thank you.
Maybe you could talk about Fellowship Point, the actual name of the place, the name of the book.
I have no idea. Honestly, I don't remember.
Oh, come on, Alice.
I really don't.
It's right there on the book.
I know, I see it. I do see it. But I don't remember when I thought of it. Larry, do you remember? No. I don't remember when I thought of it or how I thought of it. But when I showed it to my editor, she said, oh, yeah, that's perfect.
But it's odd because you also said that it wasn't as clear to you that you were writing about friendship and fellowship and what...
It was a subconscious, you know.
Mm-hmm. I understand that.
Thank you. I'm not psychologizing, but from your description, it sounds like you live in a lot of different worlds with different inhabitants, and you visit them and they visit you.
Are you here with us right now, Alice? I just want to know.
I mean, it sounds like your description of how you write. Am I misunderstanding?
No, I think that's true. I think that's the whole point of it. You know, I mean, writers come into writing from very different angles and at different ages. I came into it as a child, and as a child, it was an escape for me. I needed a place to go that wasn't my house, that wasn't my life, and I could create worlds that had where I had a lot more agency than I did as an average child in life, you know, where I had more say. As I said earlier, children don't really have that much say, even though they can act tyrannical. They don't really have that much say over what's happening to them. So I did develop that habit very early on of having, you know, other worlds to go to. Yes, and it's interesting. I was thinking about this recently that because I've had a lot of students, especially in recent years, who write some version of science fiction or some alternate realities. I mean, there are all different kinds of names for these things, and they change, but just not what's called the natural world, naturalism or realism. But I think any novel, like this novel, which would be called a realist novel, it really isn't. You know, it's very circumscribed. The circumstances are circumscribed. It really is a built world. It's a world that I built. It's not a real world. You know, we can intersect with it in ways where we bring in a lot of our own experiences and understanding. So it seems real. But I think that's true with science fiction, too. So I think it's all artifice, and it's a place to go play, like a video game or something, except a little more work, maybe. I'm not sure because I'm not a gamer, so I don't know.
I wanted to know if you have another piece of your book that you like, that you would want to read, that you haven't?
Oh, well.
Because what you read was very enjoyable.
Well.
We had one picked out. We had Maud.
All right. Yes, okay. There was another one that Beth was thinking about. This is the young character who's 26 years old. She's a single mother who lives with her mother who has chronic depression. So she's a sandwich generation person, way younger than she should be to live in that kind of circumstance. But she's also an ambitious young editor. And I really wrote her as in celebration of my millennial students. I love the millennials. And this one, Maud, would have actually been Gen X, but I was writing it when most of my students were millennials. And I just love the way they want so much from the world. And the world is not giving it to them as much as I think it should. But I liked the way they wanted so much and that the way they went after it, because that was quite different for people of my generation who just expected to work 16 hours a day for 20 years before they got, you know, to be the next rung up the ladder. The millennials want it now. You know, they don't want to wait for a minute. And though I think it's jarring to older people, it's also good. I like it. So Maud was, I made her along that model. So she's trying to get Agnes to write a memoir. And Agnes is very resistant to this, but she finally decides, okay, I will write one. And she sends it to Maud, assuming that Maud will immediately publish it. And now Maud is writing back to her about it. Miss Lee, last summer I wrote to you asking for a memoir about how you came to write the When Nan books. That's a series of children's books I mentioned earlier. What you sent me 10 months later is a highly readable and very beautiful portrait of a summer place that you know well. I love it and admire it deeply. What it is not is a book about how you came to write the When Nan series. There is nothing in these pages that answers that question, except by an oblique inference, which I can't count on most readers who are curious about you to make. You do depict small girls who have great freedom and large ambitions, and you were an unusually self-aware feminist in spite of being so close to your father. But how and why you and when you became more than a child diarist is nowhere shown. That leap is what is interesting. It's what the majority of letters you receive ask you about. Who is Nan? Was she a real little girl or did you make her up? Why did you decide she should have so many adventures and many more? Okay, then Agnes writes back. Dear Miss Silver, as you did, I have taken some time to mull your letter over. It was hard to read, of course. No one wants to have her work so easily dismissed or to be sent back to the drawing board with a few strokes of the keyboard. I have veered between incredulity and rage. I'm calm now, which you might like no better. I spent the entire winter writing that book. I agree, it is beautiful. I put in exactly what I want to put in. That manuscript explains why I wrote the When Nan books, and if the explanation is too subtle for most readers, as you seem to believe, then I'd say the fault lies in an educational system outside of my responsibility. Anyone with a jot of sense of direction will be able to go from point A to point B between my past and my books. Answering your blunt force questions will drag the pages down and drown them.
Well,
I tend to refer to the book as Friendship Point. I get when I'm asked about the book or talk about it to a friend, and I wonder why Fellowship Point was your choice as opposed to...
Well, they're Quakers, and the word fellowship is a very... frequently used word in Quaker practice. And yeah, I mean, that's why. That's why when the original founder of Fellowship Point, he thought of it as a fellowship that he was creating. So that's why it was called that. I mean, okay, there's your answer.
See, she was not being honest with me. I just don't know what to say about that.
Now I remembered. I needed a different question.
And I really am glad that you asked for that final reading. It was going to be the big reading, because I just absolutely love that relationship between the two of them and how it evolves. And also, it's not mere editor talk. It's very plot. It's very much about the plot and what you will find as the book unfolds. So, Alice Elliott Dark, you are having the ride of your life with this book, deservedly so. You're on the stage in my favorite part of this city, in literary part of the city. And I love that all of you have come here to welcome Alice and be part of this huge success story that her book has very deservedly become. Andy, thanks for having both of us, and you can have her sign your book upstairs.
Thank you so much, Beth.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.